Welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm Onofrio Castilla, senior reporter for InfraLogic, joined today by Damian Beauchamp, president and CEO of Eight Rivers Capital. Damian, thank you for being our guest.
Thanks for having me. Pleased to be here.
I wanted to have this conversation to follow on the news. We reported that Eight Rivers is raising Topco equity and is compiling an advisory roster for project finance. The project in question is the Wyoming Carbon Capture Project with Pacific Corp, which has, as you told me, a CapEx between about $1.4, $1.6 billion, and that's a 250-megawatt repowering of the Dave Johnston and Wyodak coal-fired generation units. To start this conversation, could you describe the technology you propose to repower these assets and the implications for other coal-fired assets in the U.S. and perhaps abroad?
The technology for the repowering in Wyoming is based around a technology that was invented here at Eight Rivers that's referred to as the alum-fetvet cycle. So the alum and the fetvet portions of that pertain to Rodney Alum and Jeremy Fetvet, who are the named inventors on this thermodynamic power cycle. What the power system does effectively is it'll take any fossil fuel, and Eight Rivers is focused on solid fuels, like how do we clean up the emissions from, say, coal, and it will take those fossil fuels, combust them, but then inherently capture all of the CO2 in the system without the use of an adsorbent, such that as the CO2 comes out of the system, it's at pressure and purity for utilization and or sequestration. And the other neat feature of it is that the CO2 is actually used to drive the turbine to produce the electricity. So it's a way to produce really low cost, reliable 24/7 power in a zero emissions manner. And that's what gets us excited, is the energy trifecta, as they call it, we believe can be achieved with this system.
These are coal-fired units that we're talking about, but I remember there's a biomass component here too. So could you talk about, you know, the introduction of biomass into the system, the novelty of that perhaps, and conversations that I know you've had with hyperscalers about this project and whether or not feedstock is important to them?
When you fuel the alum-fetvet cycle, or AFC as we refer to it in short, with biomass, what you end up generating is negative emissions electricity. This is something that actually goes beyond, say, a purely renewable asset like solar or wind, which generates zero emissions, where we could actually go net negative. And so what that means for the system is it primarily has two products that it can sell. One, negative emissions power, and then two, carbon removal credits. And what's really interesting is if you look at direct air capture systems today, most of them only sell one product, and that's a carbon removal credit. With AFC on biomass, which we also call biome, we're able to effectively subsidize the CDR price with the power price from the facility. And so we can achieve carbon removal credits on a per ton, dollar per ton basis that go far below what they're currently being sold in the market for today.
And those conversations with hyperscalers, are they concerned about using electricity that's generated from coal, perhaps more than they already are?
On the coal side, there still is a decent amount of sensitivity there. I do think that the biomass fired system is certainly going to be higher on the priority list because they can get the electricity, the negative emissions, 24/7 electricity that they need for their use, their data centers, while at the same time generating the carbon removal credits that they're already purchasing, but generate those carbon removal credits at a much lower price. And so effectively what it allows for is as they purchase the power, they are inherently generating CDRs. So the demand they already have is creating a supply of another thing that they want at a lower price. And we see that as really a win-win for the data center space. On the coal side, whether or not we start to see a moment where hyperscalers become less focused on fuel input, where they're less focused on fuel and more focused on emissions, we'll see what happens over time. But I think the right approach is to be focused on the emissions outcome rather than the fuel input.
Can you describe your pipeline beyond the Wyoming project a bit? How many of these do you have in the works, and at what stage of development might they be?
It's been really interesting over the past few months for our AFC system. We recently have had multiple parties come to the table wanting to effectively displace existing emitting assets with the AFC power plants. You know, I've been doing this for 10 years and I've come into a situation I didn't expect to see. And that is we have multiple entities right now vying for unit number one. And so in addition to the Pacific Corp pre-feed that we kicked off at CERAWeek in March with Wood Group, we've recently signed another pre-feed agreement with another party that is not yet public, but that work has now kicked off and is underway. And we're in negotiations with a third company to start the same. So we're effectively this year going to have three pre-feed feasibility studies running in parallel. We may have a fourth or a fifth add to that list. But then at the end of 2025, we'll be making an assessment as to which site has the highest viability to go all the way through COD, through its commercial operation date, COD. And it's exciting to have multiple options because in project development, you know, roughly 10 to 5% of projects that are announced and are kind of started at this stage actually get through FID and COD. And so when you're going into it, you want to have more than one project available. And ideally, all of those projects have different, distinct counterparty companies engaged. Because any number of circumstances can affect a project, from permitting to local and state laws to the financial circumstances of the companies that are engaged on the in the project itself. And so that diversification is key, I think, to success, especially in deployment of a first of a kind. And kind of serendipitously, that situation has started to form around what we're doing with AFC.
Are all these projects that you've mentioned clustered in the Western United States? How do you go about, you know, selecting sites for these? What are some of the key things you look for when evaluating a project or a potential project?
I wouldn't say it's kind of an East or West play or North or South. If you want to understand where we're looking at potential projects, take a map of the United States, overlay on the map of the United States all the CO2 pipelines that exist. Overlay all the Class VI wells that have either been permitted or are actively in the permit process. Then around those pieces of infrastructure and locations, draw a 50 to 100 mile radii circle. Within those areas, one has the potential to build a cost-effective AFC plant. Now, there are other factors like electrical infrastructure, access to, say, water for cooling. You definitely want to have access to fresh water. You know, if you're needing to process a highly saline-based kind of brackish water, you're going to see significant cost increases for water treatment, which aren't helpful for the overall plant economics. And so we distinctly avoid situations like that when we consider where to develop our projects. But the anchor is the CO2 infrastructure. And then from there, we start to do an assessment within that 50 or 100 mile radii to say, okay, what are the other infrastructure circumstances?
Are you evaluating any sites in Appalachia?
Appalachia would be really interesting. I think it has a ton of promise. The issue there, again, is existing CO2 infrastructure. So what I would say is, like, in the next 5 years, I don't think that it's a primary target for us. The reason being is there's no existing CO2 infrastructure. I think there's potential for CO2 infrastructure. I mean, one of the things that I think about is pipeline network that runs from Appalachia down to, say, some of the more southern states like Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. You could also take CO2 out of Appalachia by running it to the East Coast. Maybe you run it by pipeline. Maybe you run it by rail. Rail can be challenging, but it could be done. It is certainly technically possible. You could ship that CO2 down to the Gulf of the United States, where there's a whole bunch of offshore sequestration that's being developed, or at least suitable geology has been identified and acquired by various companies. And you could do that CO2 injection in the Gulf. So we've certainly thought about it. I think long term, it certainly has a lot of potential. I think it would do a lot of good for the workforce in that region and the repurposing, but also the stabilization and growth of the legacy workforce are the real advantages that we see long term and why we want to build there.
What about the price of electricity? Can you talk about the value proposition there?
The AFC was developed before there was a 45Q. So it was invented in 2010. And the first iteration of AFC received investment in and around 2012. And that was before there was a 45Q tax credit. The 45Q tax credit came later and was certainly additive. I think with inflation recently, and the fact that 45Q, since its first release and implementation, has increased three times now, it's been increased three separate times, I think that helps offset some of the inflationary considerations for projects. So it certainly helps us. And really what it translates to is a lower cost of electricity, especially for the first of a kind units, which are going to be some of the more expensive units. We target with AFC somewhere between $50 to $100 per megawatt hour as being achievable. And the range really centers in on the project circumstances. You know, there are some locations where you'll be able to monetize more byproducts than others. There's certain markets that have more elasticity on the power price side than others.
Can we talk about your plans to export this abroad, particularly to coal-dependent economies?
Yeah, our primary focus with the plants that we're developing in the United States right now is to bring in companies that are based in countries where coal utilization remains high, looks to continue, and potentially could increase over time. And we want to get them in as early partial investors to the U.S.-based projects so they can get some exposure to the technology, its performance, and kind of the development process so that they're more ready themselves to deploy this technology in their countries. And so places where we look right now are places like Indonesia, India, South Korea, Japan, Australia, things like this. Obviously, China right now is a huge consumer of coal. They're consuming more coal than the rest of the world combined. And where reductions took place in other parts of the world, China more than increased their consumption when compared to any reduction. And so China is certainly a huge opportunity for this technology, but certainly isn't the first location we're looking to deploy abroad for perhaps obvious reasons.
Those obvious reasons being, you know, of course, tariffs and the other geopolitical tensions. But the tariffs in particular, what impact could those have on your U.S. projects? You know, if there are 145% tariffs on Chinese manufactured goods or inputs, could you build these or do you have the ability to source elsewhere?
I mean, without question, there will be some level of impact. The level of impact, I think we'll understand better when our pre-feeds are complete. But having said that, we have looked at the overall supply chain for the various equipment and subsystems, if you will, that are required for a plant. And much of the equipment can be and is still manufactured in the United States, because a lot of it is compressors, pumps, valves, and then also our turbine and then heat exchangers. And because of the large presence, especially down in the Gulf of America region, there's a lot of manufacturing base and capability still within the United States, at least as it pertains to deploying, say, one, two, or three of these plants. I think if we were to start to achieve a much greater scale, it would be beneficial if the manufacturing base scaled up a bit in the United States to avoid these tariffs if they're prolonged. But for the first plant, we see it some impact, certainly. We're bracing for that. But I don't think that we're overly dependent on equipment from overseas manufacturers, or at least overseas manufacturers that don't have manufacturing facilities in the United States. Obviously, steel and like the core commodities that then go into that equipment haven't really followed the supply chain up that far, but a decent amount of that does come from overseas. So we'll have some impact into any piece of equipment that is manufactured in the United States, if that makes sense. So, and then, you know, we've got a lot of pipe in the plant that's going to take different kinds of steel, different alloys. And so depending on where those different steels are produced will obviously have some impact.
I'd like to pivot for a moment, if I could, preface this with saying that I have roots in West Virginia. I grew up near the Mount Storm Power Station. I've been familiar with the national, really international debate around coal, certainly my lifetime. This is to me something that could potentially, and I'm not seeing this anywhere, but it could potentially bring out environmental opposition in the hydrogen space. I think we saw a lot of people saying that, okay, these facilities are, you know, where blending is concerned, meant to extend the life of natural gas. And I think things like that, you know, would probably be said about, you know, prolonging the life of coal assets. Does that pose a concern to your U.S. development efforts? If so, how do you manage it?
Environmental concerns are certainly important concerns. In fact, you know, that's kind of at Eight Rivers' core. You know, we were founded upon principles of doing no harm, if you will, or significantly reducing harm to the environment. Where we chose to focus our time in how to do that was around the emissions conversation and CO2 as a greenhouse gas. Well-informed environmental groups are certainly, I think, beneficial to the country and the world overall. And we've actually, I think, found some good common ground with those groups. And I've heard the argument that carbon capture will prolong the life of any fossil fuel. I started looking into this, and here are some of the details. One, the world has never used less of any single energy resource. Even biomass. So if you look back to the 1800s, no source of energy has ever reduced in its consumption. That's biomass, that's oil, that's coal, that's natural gas, that's solar, that's wind, nothing. And so on that premise, if that's been true, then how are we to reduce CO2 emissions if we don't capture carbon from combustion? And then I looked at the fact that, well, this argument has been made for 30, 40 years. And over those 30 or 40 years, we really haven't deployed that much carbon capture at significant scale. Yet oil, gas, and coal continue to be consumed at ever-increasing rates. Again, I'm talking globally. And so how is it that carbon capture perpetuates or prolongs the life of oil, gas, and coal when over the past 30 or 40 years since this conversation has started, we haven't really deployed a whole lot of carbon capture, yet the rate of consumption continues to increase? So what I came to the conclusion at is it's not carbon capture that propagates or prolongs the use of any one of these fuel types. It happens to be economics and the fact that everybody wants affordable electricity.
Economic growth, population growth, sure.
That's right. And if you look over time, CO2 emissions have increased significantly, as has the deployment of an asset or an energy source that doesn't touch fossil fuel. So that means that the deployment of a wind or a solar is not correlated with the reduction in CO2 emissions. The thing that's going to bring correlation between reduction of emissions is physically interacting with the CO2 molecules. It turns out that as important as removing CO2 from the atmosphere may be viewed by some, it's just as important to prevent it from going in the atmosphere in the first place. And that's really what we're focused on. The other thing that's interesting about energy use over time is I looked at coal, because I've always heard these conversations about coal utilization going down. And that may be true in certain countries, but it really doesn't matter what one country does. And the reason it doesn't matter what one country does is because of the convenient or maybe inconvenient fact that the atmosphere is global. So if I reduce emissions in one country by 100%, but I increase emissions in another country by 300%, I'm net 200% over where I wanted to be as a planet. And so I looked at coal consumption because I had the intuition that coal consumption had gone down. Coal consumption has not gone down on a global basis. Coal consumption has only reduced three times. Once during the crash of the Soviet Union, a second time during the financial crisis in 2008, and three during COVID. So what does that tell you? That says you either need a pandemic, a serious financial collapse, or the collapse of an entire nation, and probably a nation that's a world power, to see a net reduction in the consumption of that fuel. And so if we're going to continue to consume that fuel, somebody better work on a solution to eliminate the emissions from it, because it's one of the most emissions intensive fuels that we use today. And that's really the foundation upon which we said, no, this is actually doing a substantial good to provide some solution to the emissions coming from this fuel type, given that the world continues to consume this fuel. And I think we also have the added benefit that we're not a legacy, we are not any kind of fossil producing company. We're simply looking for solutions to offer to the industry to eliminate their emissions. That's kind of the side we're on. And so far, many, many environmental groups have actually appreciated and I think see what Eight Rivers is trying to accomplish as overall positive.
You know, we've not had much or really any coal development in the U.S. in quite some time, whether it's Page, Arizona, or Farmington, New Mexico. The news is all about closures, or has been. We've not had new development since there's a project in Texas in 2013, and then perhaps more notably 5 years before that in northern West Virginia in Preston County. That's called the cleanest coal-fired power plant in the world, or was so when it opened. My question is, who is even prepared to do this in terms of development other than you, but also in terms of providing the money, the financing? Have you run into a lot of hesitancy in the space, or anxiety maybe?
From a financing perspective, we've identified plenty of support for offering a solution to the global emissions that coal generates. I'm not in a place to talk specifically about which groups we're talking with, but I think that there's a pragmatism that's starting to rise to the top after many decades of, I think, very good work that's been done and a very large penetration of renewable energy. And that needs to absolutely continue because it's a kind of all of the above for us. But I think that the pragmatism is starting to rise, and it kind of goes back to my previous points. And that is peak renewable deployment, peak rate of deployment, but CO2 emissions are ever increasing. And so now what I'm starting to see is corporations and companies that were against coal no matter what are now saying, well, it's not so much the fuel, it is more along the lines of the emissions that get produced. I would say on the existing coal plants and the new builds, you know, at the beginning of 2024, when the whole hyperscaler thing popped off and you started to see supply chains get constrained, I started to think about how could a company beat everybody else to the table for access to power? And one of the things I thought about was, well, you could use the demand for electricity to take over near-term retiring coal plants and actually decarbonize them based on a power offtake that would be strong enough to incentivize the building of carbon capture-based plants. And when I looked at that list, there were a whole bunch of coal plants that were planned for retirement. Well, now with the uptick of significant power demand in the United States, I don't know that we're going to see these coal plants even retire. And so that's a factor that we're thinking about. So if they're not going to retire these coal plants, well, then we need to eliminate the emissions from these coal plants. And everybody we've talked to who's looked at amine post-combustion says that it's way too expensive to put amine post-combustion on the back of these very old coal plants. And so, you know, we're one of the only groups, I think, in the United States, maybe in the world, that's, except for maybe companies I'm not aware of in China, that are looking at how do you build a decarbonized coal plant? How do you offer a solution in this space? Because if there is no solution, the thing that's going to get built is an emitting coal plant.
To close us out today, I want to ask about some of the other activities that Eight Rivers has going on. We've been talking this whole time about PacifiCorp and related projects that you have moving in the U.S. as well as investors abroad. But there's the Cormorant Clean Energy Project, the ammonia production facility in Port Arthur, Texas, that's in our database. And some of our listeners may be curious about where that project stands now in terms of development and financing. So could you talk about that just a bit?
It actually relates to the conversation we've been having, because what that Cormorant project, it's a 8H2 system. It's very similar with the oxycombustion and the recycling CO2, inherently capturing the CO2 from producing hydrogen from natural gas, but we're not using any adsorbents to eliminate the emissions. And we're taking that hydrogen to what is the largest hydrogen consumer in the world today? And that's ammonia production. Ammonia traditionally is a fertilizer, helps grow crops and food. And without it, the global population would not be able to be sustained. But there's a new application that's been identified for ammonia, and that's to co-fire it in existing unabated coal plants to reduce the emissions. So you generate the ammonia in a zero emissions manner, and then you can ship that ammonia molecule that doesn't contain any carbon and was produced in a carbon-free way, and then use that as a fuel in an existing emitting coal plant, and all that comes out is water and nitrogen from the coal fuel. And so we've been working on offtake agreements around that project. So we own 160 acres in Port Arthur. We're working our way through the permitting process of the 160 acres that we own. That's all well underway. There's been no showstoppers, and it's actually went relatively smoothly. You know, we've done a lot of the engineering, and now we're focused on offtake. We've recently signed a meaningful offtake for about 25% of the facility's production. We need to get to about 50%, and we're currently in the procurement process for another portion of the plant's production. And then on the CO2 side, we have found many counterparties that are capable and have executed a term sheet with one to take the CO2 and sequester it. And so that's kind of the status. So we're looking for some additional offtake partners, and we're also talking to prospective equity investors at the moment, with an eye soon on the debt financing portion of the project.
What will be the size of that debt financing? Maybe what's CapEx on the project? And will that 50% offtake be enough to start a project financing?
We think that the 50 to 60% is enough. We've actually heard from different financial groups that there's interest in keeping a decent portion of that supply merchant. So being able to sell on a spot basis instead of like fixing the cost structure up front for the purchase. And so that's been an interesting revelation. But, you know, overall CapEx, 1.2 to 1.4 billion based on what we've done through an engineering exercise, and then adding in some of the inflationary costs and costs that may come as a result of the tariffs.
I previously reported that on your Topco equity process, you're working with Santander. Are you able to say today who you might be working with on some of these project finances, or who you are working with?
I don't think we're in a position right now to disclose any of the advisors we're working with, but certainly talking with a few. Obviously, Santander has a very strong kind of project finance group, and they've done a lot in the renewable space. And so we look to them as a prime opportunity and partner around the project finance piece.
Excellent. Damian, this has been a terrific conversation. I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you for listening to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm Onofrio Castilla, senior reporter for InfraLogic. My guest today was Damian Beauchamp, president and CEO of Eight Rivers Capital. You can support the podcast by downloading wherever you get your podcasts, like and follow on social media. Thank you.